ever feel that God is invisible? That he is absent from the world? That he might not be active right now? Do you ever wonder how we should act in a world where others seem more powerful? Where governments seem to be in total control? Where God's people get sidelined? Did you know there's a Bible book all about that? Over the next few weeks, I'm going to be sharing my sermon series from the book of Esther. Esther's a book where God's name doesn't even come up once. But when we look carefully, God is extremely active. It's a book with conspiracies, misuse of power, supposed coincidences, relationships, and far more. Are you intrigued? Well, let's dive in, shall we? So Esther chapter 5, verses 9 to 14. Haman went out that day happy and in high spirits. When he saw Mordecai at the king's gate and observed that he neither rose nor showed fear in his presence, he was filled with rage against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, calling together his friends and Zeresh, his wife. Haman boasted to them about his vast wealth, his many sons, and all the ways the king had honoured him, and how he had elevated him above the other nobles and officials. And that's not all, Haman added. I'm the only person Queen Esther invited to accompany the king to the banquet she gave, and she's invited me along with the king tomorrow. But all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew, Mordecai, sitting at the king's gate. His wife, Zeresh, and all his friends said to him, have a pole set up, reaching to a height of 50 cubits, and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai impaled on it. Then go with the king to the banquet and enjoy yourself. This suggestion delighted Haman, and he had the pole set up. The question we're going to think about this evening is this. Who becomes God when God is missing? Who becomes God when God is missing? I mean, we all know the rule, don't we? As the oldest brother with two little sisters, I knew the rule. When mum and dad are missing, I'm in charge. The buck stops with me, I rule the roost. Or a little bit later on in life, maybe you remember this one. If you went to university, when the lecturer didn't arrive on time, then I would say, hey guys, 5 minutes, and we're all leaving, yeah? I'm sure we all have examples of things like that. When someone steps out, when someone is gone, when someone is missing, someone has to take their place, right? When the cat's away, the mice will play. We all know it. Well, we're in this section of Esther that is asking the question of who is in charge. That is the big question for this section. Who is it who is pulling the strings? Who is it that is directing the story? Who is it that is in control? Who is in charge of the world? And that is really important to know. Because if we know that, it's going to help us to make the right decisions. It's going to help us to resist the false alternatives. We saw last week the answer might be the king. King Xerxes, he might seem powerful, but we saw he's not really in control. You could say Esther, but she still has this decree looming over her head, threatening to wipe out all of God's people. Well, this evening, we're giving a look into another of the characters of Esther. And as we look at this character, as we hear his private conversation, it's going to help us think more about this question. Who is in charge? Or more specifically tonight, who becomes God when God is missing? And the answer, the big thing right here in the centre of this passage, the answer to the question is this. Me. Who becomes God when God is missing? Well, the answer is me. We've seen already in Esther that when God appears missing, people do things to take his place. Perhaps they build fancy palaces that remind you of the temple in Jerusalem. Or they construct amazing gardens that are meant to remind you of Eden. Perhaps they take the title and the language used of God and apply it to the king. That's just a few of the ways that Esther has done that for us as we've looked at it recently. But if God is missing, well, someone has to take his place. And it might as well be me. an alternative gods living in an alternative Eden. One author wrote this: God doesn't exist, and I miss him. Point being, if God is missing, then the best person to take his place, well, is me. The problem, though, with that answer is that there are many me's in the world. In fact, according to the latest data, there are over 8 billion me's right now vying for that title. And that means that there are over 8 billion people out there who want to sit on the throne. There are 8 billion people out there who, left to their own devices, would want everyone else to serve them. And if only one person defies that pipe dream, they rob us of the satisfaction that we think we deserve. You see, living in a world missing God can be a really sad and unfulfilling place to be. Mick Jagger was right on the money when he sang, "I can't get no satisfaction." That is the world we live in. It's a temptation we can all fall into. We can all be duped into the idea that believing that God is missing in this world and that putting ourselves into his position would be the solution to all of our problems. But the big point of Esther, if we remember the story of Esther, we'll have the solution to both assuming God's place and give us eyes to look at the world around us too. And so we're going to turn to this story, and there is no better place to see this issue than with our main character this evening, with the man known as Haman. We're going to take this in three sections, okay? The situation, the thinking, and the solution. Actually, let's call it the situation, the sulking, and the solution, just to make them all begin with S. So firstly, the situation. I'm going to look at verse 9. Do you remember last time, where we were last week? Haman, he's just been hanging out with the king and queen. Life can't get better than this. Wining and dining with the top brass of Persia. We're rolling right into this section from there. But all of a sudden, out of the corner of his eye, Haman spots him. He spots the man who's causing him trouble. He spots Mordecai. Verse 9. Haman went out that day happy and in high spirits. But when he saw Mordecai at the king's gate and observed that he neither rose nor showed fear in his presence, he was filled with rage against Mordecai. Mordecai doesn't rise. Mordecai doesn't show fear in Haman's presence. And the whole of Haman's day shatters into pieces. Do you see the emotional range there travelled in one verse? From the top of the world to rock bottom, as Haman is filled with rage against Mordecai. In light of the impending situation, you might think that Mordecai would be a bit less brazen than this, might be a little bit more scared of what he's doing. But we're told explicitly here that Mordecai shows no fear in Haman's presence. So what is it then that winds Haman up so much? It's that one man, the one who is not indulging Haman's delusion, the one man who's not giving in to what Haman wants, the one man who reminds Haman that he is not the god that he thinks he is. I mean, when you realise that, it's no surprise that God's people are routinely attacked for simply existing. They're kind of like beach balls at the seaside. I grew up at the seaside, so this is what we used to do. I don't know, have you ever tried this? It's a game of control. You try and push this beach ball under the water. But try as you may, it just keeps popping up somewhere else, ruining that illusion that I'm in control, that I'm in charge. See, just like that beach ball, God's people, they just pop up all over the place. And the thing with God's people is they remind you that a true God does exist. And they remind you that you're not him. They have a knack at surviving amidst attempts to eradicate them. If you are in the delusion that you are God, then that is a real issue, isn't it? That is a real issue that's going to need sorting. If we're clocking this, there's connections to previously in Esther here. You see, back in chapter 1, Xerxes was happy and in high spirits. Do you remember where he was at the end of the chapter? He was filled with rage. Same here. The so-called God King of chapter 1, and now here, the self-deluded God of chapter 5. Both having their egos popped. In fact, that phrase there, happy and in high spirits, is the phrase used in the Bible of men before they make stupid decisions. It's not going to bode well for Haman here. let's not get ahead of ourselves. What happens next? Well, verses 10 to 13, we get the sulking. We're told verse 10, Haman had to restrain himself. That is, Haman slowed himself down. And in doing that, we get a chance to pop into his head, to walk about in his shoes for a moment, to understand what he's thinking and what he's feeling. What is motivating him? What is driving him forward? So I reckon Haman must have been quite the bore. You know the kind of person, right? Shall we meet up for coffee so I can talk about myself? Shares the pictures on Instagram with the hashtag blessed. Well, that's what Haman seems to do here. He calls his friends and his wife together and then says, verse 11, Haman boasted to them about his vast wealth, his many sons, and all the ways the king had honoured him and how he had elevated him above all the other nobles and officials. Oh, I'm so blessed, Haman says. And boy, does he look it. He tells them about his money. I'm sure that wasn't a hard thing to see. He tells them about his sons. I mean, how self-centered do you have to be? Zeresh, his wife. His wife is right there. Surely she knows all about the children already. Do you see how self-centered he is? He tells them how the king has honoured him, made him higher than everyone else. Hashtag blessed. Haman gathers everyone together and tells them of his greatness, just like Xerxes did in chapter 1. Do you remember that? A full 180 days of it. The godlike Xerxes of chapter 1, now the pint-sized version in chapter 5. And not only that, verse 12, Haman says, I'm the only person who got to join the king and the queen in the banquet they've just had. It was just the three of us. It never occurred to him how sad that might sound. That it might be slightly awkward to have three people at a romantic meal. I mean, if you had any self-awareness about yourself, you'd probably think that's quite awkward. The king with his favourite beautiful girl. They've not been together for at least 30 days. Oh, and me. But you see, that's Haman's heart here. He's thinking to himself, aren't they glad to have had me there? Rather than, oh dear, I'm the third wheel. But verse 13, all those things mean nothing. Everything good in Haman's life, every blessing he's been given is void. As he quotes Mick Jagger, I can't get no satisfaction as long as that Jew Mordecai sits there at the king's gate. I mean, those words don't fit the tune, do they? But I can have all the blessings in the entire world, but whilst Mordecai stops me from living my God fantasy, I cannot be happy. Whilst he won't acknowledge me, he won't deify me, nothing, absolutely nothing is going to make me happy. Just like Adam and Eve, Haman had the entire world with permission to enjoy it, but the only thing he can think about is the one thing he doesn't have, and it eats at him. You see, in a world that is missing God, that is all that there is. There never is complete satisfaction. There's always the ongoing demand for more and more. You can see it in the world around us, whether that's the communist states, where everyone is made to be equal, or except the people at the top, or in the alternative, as John D. Rockefeller, that's the guy who owns 90% of gas and oil in his time, he said this, when asked the question, how much money is too much money? He said, well, just a little bit more. See, in our world, we know it, don't we? We know it personally. Our world, missing God, can't get no satisfaction. But they try, and they try, and they try, and they try. They can't get no. And so for Haman, his friends give him finally the solution. Have a look at verse 14. His wife, Zeresh, and his friends said to him, have a pole set up, reaching to a height of 50 cubits, and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai impaled on it. Then go with the king to the banquet and enjoy yourself. This suggestion delighted Haman, and he had the pole set up. If Mordecai won't rise for you, then you make him rise. In fact, stick him high on a pole. That'll do it. That is the solution. It's a sick, it's a twisted, it's a sinister solution, isn't it? If the man won't allow you to live as God of your own little world, then kill him. If you know the story of Naboth's vineyard with King Ahab and Queen Jezebel, there's a lot of echoes going on at this point. But this word here, pole, is actually the same word used throughout the whole Old Testament for the word tree. It's the same word that's in that verse. Cursed is anyone hung on a tree. Just Clock that. If this man won't allow you to live as gods of your own little worlds, then hang him, potentially crucify him on a tree. You see, the aim of this is humiliation. To impale, to hang someone on a tree is a public thing. Just think about it. Imagine you had all the options open. You could go for the quiet poisoning. You could go round here for the concrete shoes in the canal. You could go for the stealth assassination. They're all quiet, so nobody's going to know. Or you could do this. You could impale. You could crucify. You could hang. I mean, that's a big thing. It's loud. It's a public demonstration. Was it a public demonstration of? It was a public demonstration that one man is in charge, one man is God, and that God is Haman. Although, do notice the irony here. Once more, a woman is calling the shots. Do you remember the law at the start of this book? Every man should be ruler over his own household. It's not really working out, is it? Make it as high as possible, Haman. Make it 50 cubits. That's about 25 metres. Let as many people as possible see it. Fly it as a flag. For everyone to know what happens when you mess with Haman, the God man. Submerge that beach ball once and for all. You see Haman's reaction to that, can't you? The suggestion delights him. And so he had the pole set up. Just like a pantomime, curtains close. What's going to happen? Haman appears to be in charge. He's sat in the CEO's chair and he's got away with it. Mwahaha. I mean, the tension is high. In fact, just clock where we are in the story. Esther's about to go and plead for the lives of her people at this banquet tomorrow. Tomorrow. Yet now there's this added risk that her cousin, her defender, might be hung before she even makes that request. The stakes are high. Literally, 25 metres high. I mean, I'm trying to capture some of this pantomimeness here because I think the story does lend to it. But it is a shocking story, isn't it? I mean, we probably all know, we might not, but we may know where it's all going. But with all stories, that doesn't make the suffering in the middle easier, does it? And that is the same for us, isn't it? As Christians, we believe God has written the final page of the story. Yet that doesn't make the here and the now easy, does it? We still mourn with those who mourn, even though Jesus has won. This passage is meant to show us where life missing God ends up. It is only by God's restraining grace that we don't see more Haman strutting on the world stage today. Do you realise to say that there is a true God of this world offends everybody's ego? The kings of the earth rise up and the rulers band together against the Lord and against his anointed. And ultimately, where can people take their anger out against God? If someone wants to show that they're in charge and push God down, how are they going to do it? Well, by targeting his people. Remember, as we see a godless world, we still see God's people in the world. In our neck of the woods, it's still publicly unacceptable to do something about that. But for our brothers and sisters around the world, it's daily living. I mean, realising that, it helps us make sense of all those odd decisions that get made, the seemingly random nature of persecution. Of all the people to target in the world, why are you targeting the Christians? Well, because Christians, simply by existing, are saying that someone else is in charge. As I was writing this, one of my friends from Cornhill sent us a message. He's from a place called Manipur in northeast India. You might have seen this on the news. He sent videos of an attack happening right there and then on his church building. Totally out of the blue, seemingly random, totally unprovoked. Fire, glass, everywhere. What do you do? Well, the only thing that can help in this world, in the midst of that, is to remember who's in charge. To remember the story of Esther and know that there is someone who is in charge. That nothing is going to knock them off their throne. And how much more this evening can we know that on this side of the cross, where the world rejected the king of the universe because they wanted to be the king of the world themselves, where he was nailed to a tree for you and me. Yet where God, having disarmed those powers and authorities, made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them by the cross. That is the point of this passage this evening. You see, if we know that, if we remember that, it's going to help us live in this world missing God. And I reckon it'd be well worth our time to discuss that and to pray that now in our tables. So shall we pray that we would do that?
Thank you so much for listening. Any feedback or questions can be sent to podcast@david-couch.com, and I'll catch you again next time.